proud of this game, and you can do a great deal for football today.
The whole tradition of the National Football League, there's just certain things that go together, the family, football, and we have it all today.
Time never really stops for the great ones. It reaches out and wraps them in a cloak of immortality.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the NFL Alumni Lounge. I'm your host, Charlie Boot, and we have a remarkable man joining us today in the lounge. I'm not sure exactly where to start even. First round draft pick, five-time Pro Bowler, Philadelphia Eagles legend, Walter Payton Man of the Year Award winner, also the Wizard White NFL Man of the Year. Really, you can't stop with this guy. And currently, Executive Vice President of Football Operations for the NFL. Troy Vincent represents never stop climbing, never settle, and always deliver your best, something that the NFL alumni puts as top priority. This episode is being brought to you by Vincent Country. You can get involved with everything that Troy and his family has going on at vincentcountry.com. Faith, family, and food. That's the recipe for a well-fed soul, and they are really, really giving back to the community in major ways. You are tuned in to the NFL Alumni Lounge, and it is my great privilege to bring on a great man. Here he is, the man, Mr. Troy Vincent. Troy, how are you?
Good, and yourself? That was a wonderful introduction. Not sure if it was warranted, but I'll take it. Thank you.
Well, I don't know where to start with you. That's the thing. You put together Hall of Fame worthy career, but then what you've done off the field, what you've done for the community and for the league, you really are the complete package. So we're excited to have you on today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Let's take it back. Let's start young. Where did the foundation of the man begin? What was a typical day like in the Vincent house?
Well, I was born and raised in Trenton, New Jersey. So proud Trentonian, both my wife and I. Raised by my grandparents, Jefferson, a World War II veteran. Family from North Carolina, and after World War II, they came up to Trenton, New Jersey. My mother, Alma Vincent, raised me. So what's the typical day in life of a Vincent household? A lot of people, grandparents taking care of their children, their children's children. Mom was a correction officer, and I was just a young man in Trenton, New Jersey, dreaming to be, and people always be like, what? Man, I wanted to be Mike Schmidt. I wanted to be Andrew Tony, you know, just grew up a Dr. J fan, just dreaming every day, shooting the basketball, going to school, trying to be a productive young man, fell in love with Jesus Christ at the age of 16, and just been following the path that he's navigated for my life ever since.
That's interesting. You say at age 16. So, I mean, I'd imagine, you know, your family raised you with faith. What made you embrace at 16?
It was, I had one moment in church, had been going to church all my life. Obviously you sit there, you're sitting on the pew with your mom and you don't want to be there as a youngster. And then it was one day, happened to be going to Bible study. And I just felt like it was that day that the pastor was speaking directly to me and what he was saying about Jesus dying for my sins and transgression that each of us were. We're not here by chance. We were ordained and we're serving a God of no mistakes, a God of purpose. And it was that moment where it was like I was sitting there, had my little Bible in my hand. And it was that one time where the pastor's talking to me that I have to make some choices now as a youngster, as a teenager. Where am I going to be? Who do I want to be like? Who do I want to emulate my life to be? And that someone sacrificed so that I could be where I'm at today. It was just that moment where it was the pastor speaking to me. And typically, you know, at the end of service, they say, hey, you don't have to leave your seat if you want to, you know, get to know Christ a little bit. You want to come to Christ. Just close your eyes, put your head down and just put your hand up. But that particular day, he said, I'm going to ask that you come to the altar, come to the front of the church. And I got up out my seat and I walked forward, got on my knees. Pastor prayed for all of us. I accepted Christ that day, like truly accepted Christ that day. When I got up and I was walking back to the seat, I was like on cloud nine. Like, I just felt like I was in a different place. Like, yeah, wow. Yeah. So that was that was kind of my path to my salvation. And ever since then, I've just been, you know, the way I lead, the way I serve as a husband, as a father, as a son, as a grandson, as a league employee, as a alumni, as a legend. I live a life of service, and I just love people. I love serving the least of them. And my family has embraced that, and we do it as a family. Both my wife, Tommy, and I, and our 5 children, now 4 grandchildren. We just try to embrace family, faith, family, food.
You know, he's got a Jersey girl, so of course he ain't stepping out of line. Are you kidding me?
Nah, that won't happen. That's not going to happen.
Now, you come up in a house with a World War II vet and your mom, who's a corrections officer. So, I mean, obviously they had you on some sort of scheduling. What kind of upbringing was that? And what kind of, I don't know, scheduling or structure did they add to your life?
It was simple. You know, I grew up, my grandfather was from North Carolina, country man, grew up on a farm where they produce all of their crops and produce. So everything was about being self-sufficient. So in light of the circumstances, and hey, you're growing up in the city, it is what it is. Yep. You don't know any differently. You haven't been introduced to a different type of life or lifestyle. So this is what it is. And it was real simple. Respect people. Respect others. Grandfather, grandmothers always talk about don't pass judgment on others. You know, point that finger back to yourself. Go look yourself in the mirror. And rather than complain and get up and do something about it, always used to talk about that. And both were smokers. So to sit outside on the front porch, and as they smoked their Salem Lights or Kent 100s at the time. and, you know, you just sit there and people were hungry. People were homeless. Hey, go grab him a plate of food. Go grab her a plate of food. Oh. Hey, take her in there. Go get her cleaned up. And that was something that I just saw that they embraced. And that's how we ran, you know, okay, dinner's going to be done. When the lights flick on, the street lights come on, usually right about 15, 20 minutes before it gets dark. When those things start flickering, you better wrap this basketball game up. And if you're not back in the house, by the time that full light comes to bloom, you're not eating tonight. So just those little principles of just everyday life lessons about people, about Pat, you know, during that time in the early 70s, mid 70s, 80s, hey, my neighbor, Mr. Burt, Mr. Williams, Mr. Rogers, they have full carte blanche. If I did something wrong, they could chastise me and then send me home. So the neighborhoods, I grew up in the time where the neighborhoods was raising children together. And there was no, hey, don't you say that to my child or don't do this. No. Right. If they saw me run past, taking my bike, going up the street, and I scratch somebody's car or playing ball out on the street and hit somebody's door, oh, no. Mr. Williams was straightening it out. He was straightening it up right now. Or I might have said something. I verbalized something that I know damn well Mr. Vincent, Jefferson, or Julia are not raising him to talk that way. And guess what? Miss Mitchell was putting soap in my mouth. So I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap. I mean, like, those are the little things. Like, get over here. What did you just say?
Right.
What did you just say to him? And go, and you petrified, scared to death, and washing your mouth out with soap. So I grew up in that kind of era. And then over time, hey, you go to school, you work. As Grandpa used to say, you make an honest living, you pay your taxes, and you go vote. If you want to get involved, you want your community to do different things and look different, then you make sure you're on. I saw my parents on city council board. So it was what I saw. And I live off of those principles of, as I teach and raise our children, they know what they can be by what they see, not what they hear. And I saw that.
It takes a village, and that's incredible. And you've always been one to be a leader and to stick to the things that, you know, meant something to you. And obviously the awards in your cabinet reflect that. One of the coolest things, before we talk your playing days, I want to talk while you were on the Bills. You went to Wharton School of Business and you did something for the NFL alumni that was incredible. Setting up the ideas to bring educational programs to your players to get them ready for the life after football. What were you seeing as a player then to give you that foresight, and how did that all come about?
I was actually in high school. Those that were my coaches, youth coaches, high school coaches, then my collegiate coaches, it was always, you play a game. You play football. You don't allow the game of football or basketball or baseball or track to define who you are. And I was always taught, and I hear contrary to this belief, that you can't do both, or you shouldn't do both, or focus on both while you're a professional athlete. Wrong. I think that's the wrong. You can run parallel tracks. You can multitask. And what does that mean? Preparing for my true normal, or what my career will be after my playing experience. Never define playing as a career. An athlete should not define it that way. It's an athletic journey. Because when you start defining it as a career, career is something that you retire as. 65, 70, 55. The current athlete today is transitioning from the game in his mid-20s. That's not a career. So during my time, it was always, how do we better educate both the current and our former, our legends that have played the game, and preparing them, their significant others, for life after the game? You saw all these other businesses have done that for decades. When you look at the financial services business, you look at the consumer products business, they have week-long, 3 and 4 day workshops on learning the different traits of the business. It was 1997. I took a trip over to Wharton and I sat down every Tuesday. I was traveling over to Wharton after I left, and I was meeting with Professor Shropshire at the time, who was a professor there. And I said, we need to create a business management and entrepreneurship program for transitioning with success. Let's build a curriculum for the athlete as he thinks about transitioning. So we had the Wharton Business Management and Entrepreneurship Program. Then we went on that was in 2006 or seven. And then the following year we had success, and we said, okay, what are other interests that our alumni is having as they think about life after football? Then we went to Kellogg, out to Northwestern, and we developed an executive program at the Kellogg School of Management for marketing. That was the genesis, myself, professor, one professor leaves, and then we went up to Harvard, talked about case study and business planning, and we developed the same thing, something very similar but unique to those institutions. Today we're at, we have a program at Michigan. So that's where it was birthed out of, how do we prepare our men for transition and a successful transition in areas that they would like to focus on, not what somebody else thinks that we should be focused on? And that's how that was birthed, myself and a few others. But that's where that came. That's how that came about.
And fast forward now, you're the executive vice president of football operations at the NFL and senior VP of player engagement. Now, a question we always ask here on the Alumni Lounge is, how did you handle, and what are some pieces of advice you can lend for the transition off the field into business? But it seems like clearly you were helping write that blueprint while you were still in pads. So what was your mentality on the day you retire?
So I think life, you will be athletes, student athletes, whether you make it to the professional level or professional is transitioning out into your new normal. Transition is a lifetime. So transition will be occurring. I'm still transitioning. It begins with accepting transition and being intentional about, today I am no longer a current athlete. I am no longer an active participant. That's what I did. It wasn't who I was. And really coming to grips with, it is a new normal and it's okay. This is why it just can't start when you're finished. You're almost behind. you are behind. So you have to be, many say, you hear people say they don't have time. That's baloney. We know a professional schedule during the season allows you time to do things. I worked another job when I played.
Really?
I ran my foundation when I played. I was in business. I was in boardrooms. I was doing during the off-season programs. People say they don't have time. That's a choice. And people have made a choice not to participate. They have made a choice not to get involved. So when I hear athletes say, no, that's false. You travel, you're only away from your home for one day. You travel the day before the game and you're returning. You're back home by the 8 o'clock highlights.
Right.
You work on Monday. You have off on Tuesday. And if you won on Sunday, as Coach Reed used to do with us, we had off from Sunday evening and we were returning on Wednesday. So you have time. And the way the schedule is set up, one, by CBA, two, by the coach's schedule, there's time. But you have to be intentional about the efforts. The efforts of you learning other skills and then applying the skills that we learn in our great team sport of football, allowing those to transition and apply into your new normal or what this transition phase is and where you're going.
And that is strong advice. And folks, that's coming from a man who spent 15 years in the league, five-time Pro Bowler, but he wasn't caught in his success. He was looking ahead of himself. So now kind of to take it backwards and talk transitions again. When you're in high school in Pennsylvania, what was it like, the recruitment process for the colleges, and what made you decide to go to Wisconsin?
I was easy picking.
Yeah.
I was easy picking. People say, why would you say that? Well, one, I only played 1 year of organized high school football.
Oh, wow.
So the gym teacher, Brad Sharp, happened to tell Coach Dundella, he saw me during gym class competing, and he went to the head coach, Coach Dundell, and said, there's a young man that you should probably come take a look at. Looks like he can help your ball club out in the fall. I'm not sure if he plays football, but you should come and talk to him. Because I transferred over from Jersey to Pennsylvania, had to sit out my junior year. So my last year of high school, I went out and played, had a little bit of success. Recruiting started. So won the Suburban One Championship. Recruiting started. First person to come in. Guy walks down the hall, dark hair, baseball cap with these big old glasses. Coach Dundella says, hey, Troy, I'm not sure if you ever thought about playing college football, but I want to introduce you to Coach Joe Paterno. He's the actual head coach at Penn State University, which is 2.5 hours from the high school. And I didn't know, hey, how you doing? And so I had all of the state schools, and I was just like, Mom, I don't even know how to start evaluating college, because I was just thinking about going to school so I can get me an urban and regional planning degree, come back home, work in the city, and, you know, help you out here. And now someone's talking about paying for my education. So how do you determine what's best for you? Mom's idea and philosophy was, you're not going anywhere where anybody from the neighborhood can drive to you.
Wow.
So, whoa, okay. Okay. So what does that mean? That means that if it's in a 4 to 6 hour, within 6 hour driving distance, 8 hours driving distance, you can't come. So that eliminated all of the schools down that Northeastern corridor. Wisconsin happened to come in, Iowa. And it was like, okay, how far is that school? It was like, well, 16-hour drive from here.
I'm in.
Okay, that's the school that he's going to. I'm like, Mom, I never heard of Wisconsin. Like, where is Wisconsin on the map? And so that's literally, Coach Babish was my recruiter. Don Morton was the head coach at the time. But because it was the school that was furthest away, Mother didn't want me to come home during the holiday. And she didn't want to have anybody to have access to be able to get in a car, get on a train, and just be able to come. And as she would say, distract me from why I'm in school. And that was to get an education. That's how I got to the University of Wisconsin.
Wow. What a mom. That is, folks, that is a mom that truly, truly loves her son. Okay, so you go out to Wisconsin. And now, see, the game changed last week when they approved that now the college players can make an income. So what are some advice and what are some of the things that came at you, either temptations, challenges, different things that come at the college athlete? What's some advice you give guys?
So I would say, and so I live this today as a parent of two student athletes that are in college. One who just finished graduate school at Towson. Troy Jr. went to NC State and just finished graduate school at Towson.
Congrats.
So he's just coming off of the field. And we have a sophomore at The Ohio State University, a defensive tackle. So growing up, as our kids participated in sports as a parent, we always made sure that they understood every choice that you make, their consequences, whether they're good, bad, their consequences. Everything that may smell good or look good may not be good. And there is nothing today, and this was the advice that my grandparents gave me as I was transitioning out of college, but it applies to those going from high school that are in college today. And it was, I don't know who these people are. I never forget having Lee Steinberg in my office, in my home, 9 Faircrest Avenue, Trent, New Jersey, sitting down talking to my grandmother with a cigarette in her mouth with the dog on the floor. And he's asking questions to her about representation. I would never forget she asked a question. When did you meet Troy? What do you know about our family? And then she looked at me and said, why is he in our home?
Whoa.
And it was just that, like, Mom, whoa, what happened? And she was like, you don't know that man. He doesn't know you. And now he's saying he's going to do all of these things for our family. Does he know we've been here since the 1960s? Does he truly understand the dynamics of this family? Do you think he was actually comfortable sitting here in this living room in this neighborhood talking to us? So to answer the question, it is patience. Don't make a decision right now that may have longer term consequences, either on or off the field. Be patient. Don't allow your eyes in the temptations of worldly things like cars and jewelry. Don't be enticed. Don't think that those are worldly things. They don't get you anywhere. All of those things come in time. And if you do things right, you graduate, you finish out, you have a decent career, you have an opportunity to play bowl ball, you'll have an opportunity to purchase those things if you think those things are important to you at that time. But it's so important that they remain focused on their why and why they're there. So I have this conversation, a constant conversation with my boys on a weekly basis. As we learn from others, as we watch the draft this year. As I prepare for, I work with the NC2A on transition from college to pro. And I have what I call 8 steps of sustainability. See, because the dreamer is dreaming. See, he's just dreaming to arise. The mindset has to be, how do I sustain myself when I get there? That's what we don't talk to the athlete enough about. When you're there, because there's one thing to say, man, I made it to the draft and everyone's happy. But boy, do you know that everybody's just like you. They're great. They were all Americans. They were Big Ten defensive players of the year. They were consensus all Americans. They're big. They're fast. They're strong. But what separates those who play 3 years, 2 years, 7 years, 10 years? And being able to walk the parent and the athlete through those steps, because they're simple, simple steps that most aren't willing to embrace or commit to. Very simple steps, but most aren't willing to embrace it. So you go, as you know, the National Football League, the teams that win the most, the teams that have the most success, they're not the most talented teams. They're not the most athletic teams. They're the teams who make the least amount of mistakes on Sunday, Mondays, and Thursdays. You can look at a stat sheet, forget the roster, and I can look at it and go, field position, turnovers, big plays. I can tell you who won that football game. And then, so just driving home to the athlete as they transition, as they think about the next level? What are important for, how do you sustain yourself on a college campus, Teron, Troy? And then speaking to the rookies now as they prepare or make this transition to 284 who just either signed a contract or were drafted in the 2020 class, how do you sustain yourself? Because you just being excited that you got here won't keep you here.
What do you think is the most crucial thing a rookie, I mean, you came out first round draft pick, and like you said, you were an All-American. So what do you think the most important thing that a rookie can bring to the team is?
Availability and dependability. I'll just start with those two things, availability and dependability. And when people, well, what do you mean by that, Troy? Well, you might have played wide receiver, and you might have been all SEC, all Big Ten, all SWAC, but today you're a gunner. And as soon as you say, I don't do that, or today you just may be a hold-up guy, or today you may be a L3 or L4 on a kickoff team, or you may be a hold-up guy on a punt return team, your ability to be flexible. Most would say, I don't do that. Okay, you might have played on the left side as a corner. Guess what? Today they're going to put you in the slot. They want to make you a dime. They want to put you on the right side. Your availability and dependability. Can your teammates and coaches depend on you? Are you going to show up every day? Or are you going to live off of the hype that you had from your university? Because as we know, the eye in the sky don't lie. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, once our scouts get a hold of you, they put that film on you, they understand your strengths and weaknesses, and you're about to get exploited. And if you're not willing to commit yourself in the classroom and developing your football IQ, becoming a student of your position, you will have a short-lived stint in the National Football League. If you think going out and coming in and you're tired because you've been out on playing PlayStation will not allow you any success on Sundays, Mondays, and Thursdays.
How, when you look back at your career, you were able to be an impact player for 15 years in the NFL. All right, we're talking an impact player. How were you able to sustain that, and what was the key to keeping healthy for that long?
So it was a combination of things both on and off the field. If I could just share that, it was a combination of how you're able to sustain that. That goes back into those. These are things that work for me in my personal journey in athletics. It was self-presentation. Well, what does that have to do with on field? Because I wanted to be a professional. Never did interviews with no clothes off, with a towel around my neck. Always was respectful of the media. So that self-presentation. Two, community. We play for the people, play for our families, but the game without fans doesn't, you know, it's a different game. So engaging and being able to serve others. So that community piece was a driver for why I was playing, part of me being in responsibility of a professional athlete. Relationship management, managing all of the relationships from the quality control guy, position coach, coordinator, head coach, personnel, folks inside the media, the communications department. Managing relationships, time management, critical. One of the things that I felt like I did extremely well was I managed my time well, both at practice and when practice concluded, where I was spending my time and who I was spending my time with. Then being able to maintain my health and wellness. So athletes have to learn how to, you have to know your body. Everybody's body has a different time clock, built different, wired different. You have to know what it takes to get your body ready. Proper rest, nutrition, et cetera. Then being that student athlete on the field, having high football IQ. So I was considered a smart player, a wise player. That was only because I put the time in studying film, understanding what the coach was trying to get out of me in particular, the call, what the weaknesses and strengths were in a call, how would a team attack this particular coverage, this particular front. But that took time and years to develop that so that game day was easy. It was just it was like practice. And then the self-assessment. I'll end with self-assessment. Doing a daily self-assessment on who I was. What did I get accomplished today? Did I advance the kingdom of God? Did I get better or worse as a player? Treating practices like it was my own. Speak to any one of my teammates, my practice tempo was like tempo on game day. If my teammates could not or did not live up to that, if we all didn't have that in common, then we couldn't play together. I would go right to Coach Reed. I would go right to Coach Shula. I would go right to Coach Malarkey or Joe Gibbs. Those were my head coaches. And if we could not create that standard, it was difficult for myself and others to play with you. Because Sunday, Mondays, and Thursdays, they're just a reflection of what you did from Monday to Friday. That's just a reflection of your preparation from Monday to Friday.
I love how you said when that self-evaluation, step one was, notice that, folks, step one before anything was, did I move the kingdom of God ahead in my daily activities? That's big. What player or teammate did you get the most out of in your development as a player and as a man?
Oh, there were so many. It was so many, and it would start with, and I say this, if not for John Offerdahl. John Offerdahl was a middle linebacker with the Miami Dolphins when I was drafted there, number 56. When Coach Shula picked me up and Stu Weinstein picked me up from the airport down in Miami-Dade.
Shula picks him up.
On my way in a Crown Victoria. And as we were riding back to St. Thomas, it's where we were having camp, he had shared with me, he said, I can only protect you for so long. I'm like, protect me? You just drafted me number 7. What are you talking about protecting me? I could hold my own. But what I didn't realize what he was saying was your athletic ability will only carry you so far in this game. This is a thinking man's game. And when he said that, he says, when I drop you off, when we pull up, if you want to be a pro, I want you to go spend time with John Offerdahl. Went in, pulled in the parking lot, got my clothes, got my bag. Hey, John. He embraced me. Coach Shula said, I should follow your footsteps. Okay. Never come into the meeting room without a notebook. Never sit in back of the room. Always sit to the left or to the right side of whoever's leading the meeting, whether that's the coordinator, whether that's your position coach. You never sit in the back of the room. You sit in the back of the room with a cap on and with a sweatshirt covering your head. They're back there asleep. You have to prepare to play. That teaching from that mentor, that veteran, you take detailed notes. You are always be present in a meeting. You have to be able to apply every day what's being taught in the classroom, apply it on the field, come back in that even, get new information, regurgitate what took place that day and the days prior. You can't do that sleep. You can't do that intoxicated. And never sit in back of the room. 15 years as a starter, as a pro bowler, all pro, sat right next to the coach.
That's a leader. That's a true leader.
And I share that. I share that with the rooks. I tell them that. They go, what do you do? I said, what is that? He goes, what does it have to do with it? I said, because cool gets you cut at this level.
Cool gets you cut.
Cool will get you cut.
Love that.
If you think you're going to be cool, your playing days are numbered, buddy, and numbered fast. They're going to split your wig fast. And it was being able to listen, see, and process what the coach is trying to get out of the call and what teams and team philosophies are trying to do to you. But you have to listen. And then when it's hot, so there's no way you're going to be asleep on Tuesday or Wednesday when you're doing first and 10 cut-ups. You're back in the room sleep. It's 110 outside. You got 2-a-days. And you got multiple days of that, and you think you're going to go and remember that on a hot Sunday afternoon at the time, Joe Robbie Stadium? People moving, people flying around, motion is going on, you hot, it's the middle of the third quarter. You think you're going to remember what the coach told you on Tuesday morning?
No chance.
No chance. Not a chance in the world. So those are the things. Again, they're simple, actually simple tools. But oftentimes the athlete, no differently, going from high school to college, you get to the school And now you get, because you were, you get so enamored with being a Buckeye, being a Badger, a Crimson Tide, you get so caught up in that, you forget why you're there. And not realizing, just like in high school, going to college, they're recruiting around you every day. At the pro level, you get enough minuses during the week, you're going to look in the corner during practice. You go, why those guys over there backpedaling? Because you're not producing. It's not personal.
It's all business.
It's all business. So that comes back to, we have to continue to talk and to share about sustainability. How do you sustain yourself? We always talk about the things you shouldn't do, places you shouldn't go. We get enough of that. When are we going to start feeding them life? When I say feeding them, the athlete life.
You guys understand now. Everybody listening understands the intro that you said, I don't know if it's warranted. Yeah, it's warranted and more. To talk about just the man, did you realize how historic it was in 2002 when you took home the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award and the Wizzer White NFL Man of the Year Award? Did you realize how historic and powerful that was?
No, it was, you know, when I got a call, it was, hey, you were... you know, named or nominated. I'm like, I didn't know I was nominated, let alone there's so many other people out there doing good work. But the wife and I, we've been, as we would say, we've been pounding the streets for years. And at the time, the gravity of what it was and what it represented, I mean, you're just going on with life. You're just serving people. You're just doing what we did on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. We have been doing that work for years and continue to do so. And for someone to recognize you for the work, obviously, it's an honor. It was a great honor. We appreciate it. We're always humbled that someone, you know, recognizes the work. It's not why we do it, but during that time in 2002 and 2003, the magnitude, knowing that now I have a better history of the individuals like Bart Starr and those individuals like that who had received that prior to myself, Joe Green and others, you now say, wow, I'm part of a pretty unique fraternity for what we would consider the best of the best of the National Football League. That's both on the field success as well as off the field giving.
Complete man. And I mean, you based it on faith, where you can't go wrong when you build something on faith. What's been the coolest thing for you since forming the Troy Vincent Foundation? Well, what's been the proudest moment?
Just the ability to give back and give back at home. Mm. And now my wife and I'm proud to be able to serve with my family now. So before it was just my wife and I, we had one daughter. And now with we have five children and four grands, our family is serving together. Like we... our kids are now, hey, Dad, what are we doing this year for such and such? Hey, Dad, what are we doing around the homeless? Hey, what are we doing around X, Y? So to see that come to pass with the family, has been the proudest moments. And now we are able to, we started off in Trenton, New Jersey with the families there. In the school systems, we're still there. We're now, you know, to take that work and go to Baltimore, to Virginia, to Detroit, to Dallas, to Miami, and take that service work into other places and sow a seed with others. Those are proud moments year in and year out.
We got to ask you to do for us on, you know, maybe you could influence there at the league office. And that's, we miss the old draft logos. We were looking at this morning, the beautiful logo from your draft class, the 92 class. Well, we missed the Super Bowl logos. Each year had its own logo, and the draft, that's all we want. Can we get it back?
And I do believe this. I do believe due to what we saw take place, I would just say to be able to educate on where the draft and how the draft has evolved. 1992, there were 10 people, 8 people that got invited to New York.
Wow.
I went to a hotel at the Marriott with a wooden podium with a Velcro sticker that said the 1992 draft with about 4 or 5 other people, you know, and about, I don't know, less than 40 people in the hotel room. okay, to now looking at this massive production. But what we saw last week with the throwback jerseys, being able to go back in time and share different through different generations of the draft, I think it woke us up to say, you know what, we can be a little bit creative, and the same thing would apply for the Super Bowl. That moment of celebration, the moment of working together, seeing families, but most importantly, being part of an organization. Man, we raised over $100 million for the frontline workers with the draft-a-thon.
Amazing.
Like, to be able to do all three of those things together inside of what we call the stay-home orders, or what is called the stay-home orders, being in compliance, operating your business, celebrating, giving America an alternative from what we've been seeing the last 8 weeks. That's all, just an alternative. Celebration gave people some hope, and we raised a ton of money for the frontline workers. Like, that was a special moment for myself.
Yeah, no, it was a special moment for America, because everybody's been starving for some form of entertainment, live sports, something. And the NFL draft comes, and everybody was sad that, you know, the big Vegas production was pulled. But the way that the NFL put that production together was incredible. That was a flawless presentation right there.
Well, that's what happens when you work together.
Yep, teamwork makes
and
a dream.
Partners, work. Yep. And everybody came together for just one common cause for those 3 days, and we saw it all kind of work. And I just hope we all keep that same mind frame as we work as partners, community, and everybody's included. We have our rightful place, and sport has its rightful place in society.
And man, I swear I could pick your brain all day, but I wanna wrap with you here. As we just celebrated the 100th birthday of the league, as the current executive vice president of football operations at the NFL, what would you like to see the NFL leave here on culture over the next 100 years?
One, inclusion. So, you know, we had some proud moments during our 100-year celebration. And also, there was a reality that we're not where we can be as it pertains to inclusion. We represent America. Our sport does. We come from all walks of life, a male, female. I would like to see, let's be intentional about being a true inclusive sport. Everybody matters. Football is for everyone. As we talk about innovation of the game, embracing technology. So finding the right integration of tradition and innovation coupled with true inclusion.
Troy, you're everything an NFL alumni could hope to be. We're so proud of the man that you are, how you've, you know, carried yourself on the field, off the field, and what you're doing for the league today. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the Alumni Lounge.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the time. Hope I answered all your questions. I hope your listeners or viewers, I hope I gave them a glimpse of at least my world, where I've come from, and what the Lord has done in my life, and what I'm currently focused on today as a father and as a league executive.
Absolutely. God bless you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That right there, folks, is an episode that young college athletes and guys just headed into the league should have on repeat. Gems on gems on gems. Thank you so much to Troy Vincent and the Vincent family for everything they're doing at Vincent Country. Again, to get involved with a great organization, visit VincentCountry.com. I think the NFL made a great decision and is in great hands with the leadership right now, and giving Troy the position that he has to make an impact on the lives of so many athletes. I thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of the NFL Alumni Lounge. Be sure, as always, to subscribe on Spotify, Apple, and all major streaming platforms. And follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at NFL Alumni. We've got a really cool one next week, one that connects to Troy Vincent. Hall of Famer Brian Dawkins will be joining the lounge next week. Troy Vincent is actually the man that presented Brian Dawkins into Canton, so it's a beautiful full circle story. I'm your host, Charlie Boots, and this will do it for another episode of The Lounge. Thank you guys for tuning in, and I'll see you here next week. Cheers.